Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, it's Friday, and Dan Hoost is here from Sullivan County Government with the latest from the legislature. In Woodstock, leaders are under fire after a convicted sex offender was hired for a public job. How did he end up on the town payroll, and why did it take weeks to remove him? We talk with the editor of The Overlook, the publication who broke this story for the latest on Woodstock's biggest political crisis in years. There's a new spot in Livingston Manor that's bringing people together over tamales and tradition, where Chef David Perez making tamales is more than about food. It's about memories. We stop by Suenos to get a taste. Plus a sneak peek from the latest edition of the theater podcast Curtain Call with Tom Candela. But first, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The White House says the leaders of Armenia and Azerbaijan will meet with President Trump today and sign a roadmap for a peace agreement. Both countries are former Soviet satellites. They've been at war for years, ever since an enclave in Azerbaijan broke away with help from Armenia. Russian President Vladimir Putin and President Trump could meet as early as next week in the United Arab Emirates. It would be the first summit for the two leaders since Russia launched its full-scale attack in Ukraine 3 years ago. South Carolina Public Radio's Mayan Schechter reports U.S. Senator Lindsey Graham says he's glad the two leaders could talk.
Senator Graham says Trump has followed the roadmap of his sanctions bill that now has 85 co-sponsors. It would impose up to a 500% tariff on imports from countries that buy Russian gas, oil, or uranium. But the bill has not moved, and Graham says he's worried Trump's own tariff plan could fall flat in court.
His ability to issue tariffs, I think, is going to be legally challenged. And I don't know if he wins or loses, but the bill would allow him to do the same thing.
Whether Graham thinks Putin is sincere in calling for a meeting, Graham said, quote, "I don't trust him as far as I can throw him." For NPR News, I'm Mayan Schechter in Columbia, South Carolina.
The Israeli Security Cabinet has approved a plan to expand the war in Gaza and take control of Gaza City. The decision has drawn strong criticism from other nations, and opinion is divided within Israel. Some Israelis say the first priority should not be a military one.
I know the plan is to get rid of Hamas, but we've been trying for 2 whole years. We haven't made that much progress, and we've lost so many soldiers, and we still haven't brought all the hostages home. So it just doesn't seem that there's any real forward movement with this plan.
Tens of thousands of Israelis protested across the country yesterday. Stocks opened higher this morning as President Trump names a short-term pick for the Federal Reserve Board. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose about 220 points in early trading.
President Trump says he plans to nominate White House economist Stephen Miron to a seat on the Fed's 7-member governing board, but only for the next 6 months. Fed Governor Adriana Kugler created the short-term vacancy when she announced last week she's leaving the central bank early to return to her job at Georgetown University. Kugler's term was set to expire in January. Trump says he's still looking for a nominee to fill the Fed seat on a permanent basis. The president's been critical of the central bank for not moving more aggressively to cut interest rates. The Fed's been cautious out of concern that Trump's tariffs could rekindle inflation. Asian stocks were mixed overnight. Japan's Nikkei average jumped sharply, but stocks were down in Hong Kong, Shanghai, and Seoul. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow is now up 225 points. The Nasdaq is up 130 points. This is NPR. The White House says President Trump has ordered more federal law enforcement to appear on the streets of Washington, D.C. Trump has recently criticized D.C. over crime. He's pointed to a recent attack on a former DOGE worker in the city. The president has also threatened a federal takeover of the Washington district government. NASA is accelerating plans to put a nuclear reactor on the moon. As NPR's Chandelise Duster reports, some researchers believe it's time, but others worry about the cost.
A new directive from acting NASA Administrator Sean Duffy calls for development of a nuclear reactor for the moon by 2030. Roger Myers is a space nuclear power expert. He says that nuclear power is the only option for astronauts facing 2-week-long lunar nighttime.
The sun and batteries does not work. we're going to have nuclear power.
Myers applauds the decision to accelerate the nuclear power program. But Katie Huff of the University of Illinois is worried the Moon reactor will come at the cost of other important work.
Earth science, climate observation, space-based weather forecasting, all the kinds of things that NASA does in a public-serving way for our day-to-day needs.
The Trump administration has proposed slashing those programs in next year's budget. Chandelise Duster, NPR News.
Wildfires continue to grow in the West. The Gifford Fire in Southern California has spread to more than 150 square miles. Evacuations have been ordered in Santa Barbara and San Luis Obispo counties. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Capital One with the Capital One Saver Card. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at MacFound.org.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. And joining us on Friday, August 8th, as he does every Friday, or most Fridays, I guess. You do have some time off occasionally. Dan Hoost, communications
when
director
for When you let me.
When I let you, right?
Yeah.
You know. Be sure to fill out your hours before you leave. Dan Hoost, communications director from Sullivan County Government. Good morning.
Good morning. And I just want everyone to know Tim has a really cool shirt on.
It's our 35th mm-hmm. anniversary. I'm wearing our mm-hmm. 30th anniversary T-shirt that was designed by artist Christy Johnson, which I found in my drawer this morning as I was searching for something. I'm like, oh, wait, I haven't worn this for a little while. But we have our 35th anniversary T-shirts now as well. And we'll be at Bagel Festival, as I think you guys are going to be there.
I will be there representing Delaware Valley Arts Alliance. But also, yes, we're going to have county government folks there who I'll probably do double duty and take some photos of. Yeah, it's going to be a big party. I mean, my gosh, when you go and see Broadway packed with people from end to end, it is amazing.
That's Sunday in Monticello, the Big Bagel Festival. We'll be there with our merch, and you can see Dan as well. If you mm-hmm. only hear Dan, you get to see Dan on Sunday.
Right. It's not hard. I'm the tallest guy around with the bright, shiny, bald head.
Look for him. Let's talk about the legislative meeting yesterday, some of the topics that came up. Legislature considering working with local school districts to add some cameras to school buses. Why is that? Is there something going on that we need to see?
Because people continue to pass these school buses when they're stopped with their red lights on and their stop signs out. It is utterly horrifying to me, and we got to watch videos of it yesterday at legislature. You can watch them yourself if you go onto our website and take a look at the, I believe it was the Public Safety Committee meeting. Had a gentleman there from a vendor who's possibly interested in providing this service, and they're not only passing, people are not only passing when the buses stop with the lights on, but when the kids are trying to cross the road and the kids almost get hit.
Wait a minute. So the school bus stops, the red lights come on, the stop sign pops out from the side. Mm-hmm. It has lights that flash as well. And people are passing the school bus? Mm-hmm.
They don't want to wait.
My gosh.
Yes. And they are putting lives in danger.
Yeah.
And it is something that we in the local school districts want to put a stop to. So conversations have been ongoing with our public safety commissioner, Scott Schulte, for a while with our local school districts. I believe Monticello may already do this from what he told me, but he's like been talking with Sullivan West and other school districts about adding cameras to school buses, which would passively film when the lights are on. So it would be like sort of kitty corner at the front of the bus, the side of the bus, and kitty corner at the back of the bus, showing the whole opposite lane there, only triggered when the lights go on and the stop sign flips out. And if somebody passes, it will capture their license plate and the owner of that vehicle will get a ticket in the mail. Now, this is a civil ticket, not a criminal ticket. So there was some conversation in the legislature yesterday of, well, how can you enforce this? Because this is not something that you can call somebody to court on. It's different from like if a police officer was there to witness it, they would actually give you a traffic violation, which is a criminal citation. This is a civil citation. However, it would come with fines of $200, $250 and up, depending on how many times this infraction had happened. And the idea is that it becomes more of a deterrent rather than something where we have to really go and enforce, because people will be made aware that the cameras are on these buses. And if you pass, you're going to be recorded. So legislature is very interested in this. No commitments were made yesterday. Not sure of who we're going with, what vendor, but Commissioner Schulte and our Public Safety Committee Chairman, Louis Alvarez, our legislator, continue to diligently work on seeing this through.
Yeah. I mean, stop for the school bus. I mean, really.
You should, but people don't. And crazy. It happens here in Sullivan County. Crazy. You talk to any bus driver, and I bet you they'd tell you it's happened multiple times.
Let's talk about an update on Sullivan County Head Start. Now, Sullivan County Head Start back last year, I believe, abruptly closed. What happened there, if we can just recap for folks? And then what's new now?
Right. The original operator, Sullivan County Head Start, the federal government swooped in and basically said, we need to take things over here. Sullivan County Head Start continued on paper for a while. I don't know that it's active any longer. It didn't have anything to oversee. But CDI, who was a contractor for the federal government, came in and has been operating the program for the past a little over a year, I believe. And now it has been announced, our Community Resources Commissioner Laura Quigley told legislature yesterday that the Orange County Head Start is going to take over the Sullivan County program. It's not going away. Mm-hmm. It's not being moved to Orange County. It will actually be run as has been intended by a nonprofit Head Start. CDI always was intended to be temporary.
All right. So it will be absorbed into the Orange County Head Start. So this will help effectively stabilize the program.
Yes, that's our understanding, and keep it permanent. They have a 5-year contract that begins November 1st. I believe that's when they're going to take things over. They'll probably be doing it a little earlier than that because the school year starts before then. But they are going to at least be there for the next 5 years committed to it. So it's really good news for what had been a very tough situation mm-hmm. for very vulnerable kids and their families.
There was also, an emergency meeting for something that seems to be somewhat simple, I suppose, right. in some ways, but because of the way the laws and the legislature operate, you guys had to have an emergency meeting to replace an unrepairable dishwasher at the care center.
Because it was an emergency repair. The dishwasher had conked out. And our typical procurement process takes several weeks, if not months. We try to be very responsible sure. with taxpayers' money. I know when I want to purchase something, even advertising or whatever, it takes a long time and hoops to jump through with the purchasing department so that our audit department doesn't throw that back in my face and say, no, this wasn't authorized and the county's not going to pay for it. So what this needed to be done, though, was since we need a dishwasher, and this is an industrial level dishwasher for our care center, the legislature said, listen, we'll meet in emergency session and we will authorize, I think it's a $10,000 a year lease for it, and so that we can make sure that residents of the care center have clean plates and dishes to eat with. So this was something nobody had a problem with. It unanimously passed yesterday. It is still being handled responsibly. There will be checks and balances. It's not just a blank check being given to a vendor, but it allows us to immediately replace the dishwasher.
And also the Public Safety Committee passed a resolution offering EMT training scholarships.
Mm-hmm. Yes, this is interesting. And now, this has not passed the full legislature yet, but I do expect it to. The legislature in the resolution said they recognize the critical need for well-trained emergency medical technicians, EMTs, within Sullivan County. So to support recruitment and training in the EMS field, we are entering into an agreement with SUNY Sullivan to fund EMT student scholarships to reduce financial barriers and encourage enrollment in the college's EMT program, which I'm not sure how many people realize they have that. And this is a great career. This is a competitive paying career with certainly no lack of things going on. You're always working on serious medical issues, and we need people like that in our community more than ever before. So if we could help fund people's entire tuition to learn how to become an EMT and then have a good career with it here in the community, it's a win-win all the way around.
We're talking to Dan Hoost. He's the communications director for Sullivan County Government. He joins us every Friday with an update from Monticello. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, some news about one of the legislators who's got some national recognition. And it's only August 8th, but we're already talking about Election Day. That's next. You're listening to Radio Catskill.
Support comes from Garnet Health Medical Center, Catskills, with campuses in Harris and Calicoon, offering inpatient and outpatient services to Sullivan County and surrounding communities. Learn more at garnethealth.org.
On the next Jazz Night in America, we're in Rhode Island for a show of dynamite music from the Newport Jazz Festival through the years, handpicked and hosted by me, Christian McBride. We've got a power hour of all-stars with some of the best sets to come out of the modern era of the fest. Herbie Hancock, Roy Hargrove, Cecile McLaurin-Savant, and maybe a little bit of music from me. That's next time on Jazz Night in America. I'm Christian McBride. Sunday at 8, here on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. We're joined by Dan Hoost from Sullivan County Government, live in the studio. Some other updates from the legislature. Wanted to talk about the housing issues that we've been addressing and you've been telling us about. What's the latest on the housing crisis and how the legislature is planning to tackle that?
Well, this is really great, actually. Sullivan County's Department of Social Services received this news at the end of July that requests made earlier this year were approved to increase authorized public assistance payments. They're known as PASS supplements to clients for their housing. So the State Division of Budget agreed with counties' collective position that it makes much more sense to pay rents than hotel rates. So families of four who prior to July 25th were receiving a maximum of $335 a month to pay for their housing are now entitled to a maximum of $1,039 per month. And our local social services is currently reviewing cases to see how exactly this will help us get more folks from emergency to permanent housing. It's only available to people and families who qualify for public assistance, but DSS's hope is that this change will allow us to free up funds for people in need of housing assistance who do not currently qualify for public assistance programs. So this is a major thing that is coming, and amidst all the news of cuts and things changing, this is wonderful to say, no, we're increasing to get people out of hotels and into permanent housing.
Another update I wanted to bring folks, the public health advisory about rabies. There was rabies detected in Grahamsville. Was that, it was a fox, I believe?
Yes, it was a gray fox that tested positive for rabies. It's no longer with us, but rabies certainly is. So anytime we find a positive tested in community, we try to bring, public health tries to bring a free rabies vaccination clinic there for dogs, cats, and ferrets. That will be held on August 19th from 6 to 7:30 p.m. at the Neversink Firehouse in Neversink. That's on top of the one that's happening the week before at Hanafy Park in Liberty. That'll be on August 12th from 6 to 7:30 p.m. This is free. You don't need to pre-register for it. You just need to bring proof that you're a Sullivan County resident and, of course, make sure those pets are on a leash or in a kennel.
Another update on something we've been talking about, security at the government center. The new scanners are operational. How's that going? Mm-hmm. What's the reaction been?
Yep. The scanners actually have been adopted very quickly by people. They're used to them in all sorts of other places. And we have tried very hard, and I think with great success, to make it as hassle-free as possible. For me, for example, who walks in without any kind of bag or anything on me, I just simply walk through the scanner and I'm on my way. I don't know that it even takes a second more than it did when I was walking in and there was nothing there. If you have a bag, obviously you got to put it in a container. It runs through the bag scanner, but typically your bag will beat you to the end of the line there. And there's really not been any long lines with people waiting. The longest line I experienced was just somebody was like, oh, I need to do this now. So they were finding the right place to go in. But we have sheriff's deputies who are happy to help. And I think it's not only been a success in getting people efficiently into the building, but also in upping our security. We've not found any guns so far on folks. They know not to bring those into a municipal building. That's illegal. But we have found knives and not people who were looking to do any harm with them that we've found so far, but knives that are longer than 3 inches in their blade length, which is not something that we want in the building. So, but people have worked very well with us, and we're very, very pleased that it's been adopted as fast as it has been.
Also, so, a child care funding update to let folks talk about.
Yes, this was another really good piece of news. You know, since July 1st, I had talked about this before, we've been unable to approve new participants and recertifications of current recipients for child care assistance help from the state due to a shortfall in state funds. This is statewide that it's an issue. But now we have found that from New York State Office of Child and Family Services that our subsidy allocation for this coming year, it's 25 to 26, is about $222,000 more than we got last year. Now, even that's not going to be sufficient to support the increased demand due to the broader eligibility for the program, but it's $222,000 more than we got before. So again, just like the other thing with social services, with the housing assistance, we have more money to go around and we are going to make good use of that.
It is a height of the summer, a stretch of sunshine for the weekend. And of course, that means to start thinking about Election Day. It's
you sound more excited about that, Tim.
I really should. 3 months, a little less than 3 months away, believe it or not. You're already looking for election inspectors for early voting. When does early voting
start?
We
are always in need of election inspectors. And these are the folks who, you might call them election clerks or whatever, but they're the folks that sit at those tables and welcome you, hand you material, explain anything that you need explained, make sure if there's a verification process, like that you're in the voter rolls, that kind of thing. And they are in two locations, Government Center and Public Health, for early voting, which will start on October 25th and run through November 2nd. And then they will be scattered throughout, I think there's well over 30 polling sites in Sullivan County on Election Day of November 4th.
And those folks get paid for this.
They get paid $300 a day for this. We'll also pay for their training, which happens, I believe, in September. So we need people to tell us now that they're interested. We need all hands on deck for this. Give a call to our Board of Elections, 845-807-0400. That's 807-0400. They will be thrilled to hear from you. Trust me.
The Human Rights Commission has a meeting coming up on Wednesday. Where is that going to be?
Yep, 5 p.m. Government Center in the hearing room on the second floor where the legislature meets. These meetings are open to the public. And if you have an interest in human rights or just want to see what our Human Rights Commission is doing and talking about, you are welcome to come and watch this. 5 o'clock, it'll probably run for an hour or two. You don't have to stay any longer than you want to, but it is definitely open to the public.
Some news about legislator Luis Alvarez. He was appointed to 5 committees of the National Association of Counties. Wow.
Yeah. Isn't this something? So last year, it was just one. I said to him this year, I said, what, are you glutton for punishment? You tell him, oh, sure. You know, I got more time in my schedule for all of this kind of thing. He said he's just proud to serve on the National Association of Counties. He already serves on the board of the New York State Association of Counties. So it makes sense that he's going to be on the National Association of Counties. And he's on everything from health committees to immigration reform committees. And what these committees on a national level do is advise Congress members and our lobbyists for counties how counties throughout the United States would like to see these important issues handled. And to have one of our own legislators on these national committees, and he's the only one from Sullivan County that are on these things, is just an incredible thing, a great honor for him and an honor for Sullivan County too. A feather in our cap means that we're affecting things at the national level.
And before we go, 10 new citizens sworn in this week by County Clerk Russell Reed.
It's my favorite thing to cover. Every few months, I take a video and photos of new immigrants who have become citizens, have gone through usually a years-long process. They're from all over the world looking to become American citizens. It was wonderful to see this past week, and I have their oath of allegiance on camera on our social media. Take a look. It will warm your heart and make you feel good.
Dan Hoos from Sullivan County Government will be back at work on Sunday at Bagel Festival. Trying to get folks to take the bicycle and pedestrian master plan survey, as well as other information you'll be providing there.
And I think our human resources folks will be there. I believe our public health folks will be there. So there's going to be quite a turnout of them. And listen, there's going to be over 200 vendors. Yep. There will be something for everyone there to see, including me, tall, bald, and shiny.
They really should call it the Dan Hoost Festival. I'm telling
you.
No.
I don't look like a bagel. Do I?
No.
Do I?
No. We'll see you there.
right. Eating one.
Have a good week.
You too.
We'll take a break. And when we come back, The Overlook is the new nonprofit news outlet serving the Catskills. They uncovered a big story in Woodstock about a controversial town hire, which led to heated board meetings and protests on the village green. The Overlook's editor-in-chief joins us next. This is Radio Catskill.
Next time on City Arts and Lectures, former Secretary of Labor Robert Reich talks about his book, Coming Up Short. The new memoir examines the impact of powerful corporations, economic inequality, and political demagogues. It's also an account of Reich's personal experiences with bullying. That's next time on City Arts and Lectures on this public radio station.
City Arts and Lectures, Sunday afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
Hey, it's Ira Flatto from Science Friday. Public media organizations just lost federal funding, and it is a big deal. This cut will have serious long-term consequences for the service we provide to you unless we replace that funding with support from more listeners. The future of public media is in your hands, so please go to the station's website to start or increase your monthly sustaining donation today. And thanks.
Give now at WJFFradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Now, a story that's shaken up town government in Woodstock. Michael Anello, a level 3 sex offender, was hired earlier this year as a town maintenance worker, a decision that sparked outrage when his criminal history came to light. After weeks of public backlash, ethics complaints, and a standoff within the town board, Anello has now been officially terminated. To help us find out what happened and what it means and where things go from here, we're joined by Noah Eckstein, the editor-in-chief of The Overlook, who broke this story. Noah, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thanks, Tim. Tim, good morning, everyone.
And for folks who haven't been following this story, Noah, can you walk us through what happened and how this all started? How did he get hired?
So in March, he was hired, and it turns out he has a personal relationship with the supervisor's confidential secretary. And in 2014, the town of Woodstock, like many towns across the state, banned the box that asked information about criminal convictions and felonies in the application process. And in March, he was hired part-time. In June, that went to full-time, and sort of around that time in July, in early July, the hiring committee, which was comprised of other town board members, found out that he was a level 3 sex offender, and ensued a summer scandal that has rocked the town of Woodstock. In July 22nd, the town had a meeting, and 3 of the 5 town board members voted to terminate the employment of Michael Anello, and the board supervisor, Supervisor McKenna, waited about two. He just stalled on that. He completely waited, and then last week, after speaking with lawyers, Manuela Cordes, who's the Democratic nominee for supervisor, because Bill's term is ending at the end of the year, she signed the change of personnel order and submitted it to the Ulster County Civil Service. And according to the county, he is no longer employed by the town of Woodstock.
It sounds like there was some serious tension inside town hall. The supervisor refused to act on the board's vote to fire Anello. Can you talk about the board members who took matters into their own hands, and what did they do and why?
Yeah, the tensions have been high. I've been covering local government for many years, and this was the only town in which I thought there would be some sort of physical violence. Just things were, hands were flying in the air, and things were getting very tense. The July 22nd meeting, a lot of members of the town of Woodstock, some of whom were sexual assault survivors, came in very, very impassioned by the hiring of Anello. But in terms of the other board members, so Anula Cordes, Bennett Raycliffe, and Maria Elena Conti voted to terminate Anello's employment on July 22nd. Laura Rickey abstained, and McKenna refused to vote. But McKenna is going to leave office at the end of the year with his final term, and this has really been overshadowed by the hiring of Michael Anello. In this week's edition, we published an analysis of the situation and also contextualize his broader 8 years as supervisor. Mm-hmm. And really, after weeks of public outcry, the town board acted. Really, that action was led by Anula and Bennett. And this week, you know, the Overlook broke the news, and we confirmed that Anello has been fired. So the controversy has just raised serious questions about transparency, judgment, right, and how second chances are handled in positions of public trust.
Is there any indication the town violated any hiring rules or broke any laws, or is it just more of a failure in transparency and communication?
I would say it's more the latter. It's not a breaking of any laws. It's an ethical thing.
And talk about the public outcry. How strong has that community response been?
There's going to be a protest tomorrow on the Village Green in the town of Woodstock, calling for McKenna's resignation. The July 22nd meeting was completely packed. There were like 40 or 50 people there, and this has just been ensuing on social media. I think some residents, you know, think that in terms of rehabilitating, you know, Anello served 5 years in prison for the crimes that he committed, and some view this as, you know, level three sex offenders and people who have committed crimes who have paid for those crimes deserve a chance to be employed, and that's a part of their reintegration into society. But I think the key issue here was the transparency aspect, that McKenna did not disclose that information transparently to the other town board members who were making the hiring decision.
There's an upcoming town board meeting on August 12th, I think. And what are you watching for next now with that coming up?
Well, the supervisor is not answering my calls. It's been hard to get him on the phone, but it's likely to be a pretty contentious and just tense board meeting. You know, the county has said that he's terminated, but whether McKenna is complying with that or how that is working out is unclear at this moment.
Why do you think this story struck such a nerve in Woodstock? And do you think it has anything to say about trust in local government right now?
I think it struck a nerve particularly because it was found out that the summer rec camp, you know, Anello was a maintenance worker in the town of Woodstock, and he was seen sort of within 60 to 100 feet of the town pool near the rec camp. So I think it has to do with process and the fact that McKenna did not reach out to the town librarian, the chief of police, who told us that he wished he knew about this sooner. So it very much felt like a protection of Anello, and I think it blew up because people want to feel safe and want to have, you know, as much knowledge about the people who are working in town as possible.
And you mentioned you guys broke this story. The Overlook, relatively new community journalism serving Hunter, Hurley, Olive, Saugerties, Shandaken, and Woodstock. You come out every Friday online at theoverlooknews.com. Also, a lead story today about the Canadian wildfire haze.
Yeah. Next week is going to be our 6 months of 6 months of publishing weekly. But yeah, this week, Canadian wildfire smoke drifted into much of New York State, sending air quality in our service area over over 100, that air quality index score. So that's levels that are considered quite unhealthy for sensitive groups. State officials expanded advisories to cover most of New York, warning about both the fine particulate matter and ozone pollutions. And experts from the DOH told us that climate change is making these events more frequent. And one official put it that the climate changed, so we need to change. And he, who was a spokesperson for the Department of Health, the State Department of Health, said that checking the AQI, the air quality index, in the future is going to be like checking the weather.
Mm-hmm. And just congratulations on 6 months next week. How's it been for you as editor-in-chief and starting up this new way to serve folks with journalism in the area?
Yeah, it's very exciting. It's a dream come true for me. We have a lot of exciting things planned. We're very much a small community nonprofit journalism outlet with a really small team, but we're growing and bringing on new reporters. You know, interestingly, in the past couple of weeks, we hired a reporter named Jim Rich, who was the former editor-in-chief of the New York Daily News. And he's sort of coming back to local journalism. So we're experiencing this wellspring of just interest in local news at a time when trust in the national news is waning, and people feel like, you know, the way that they receive their news is so fractured that local news is a place to invest time and efforts, because it is this returning to community that has been so important to a lot of our readers.
Absolutely. And you're already doing some great journalism, great reporting. You can read about the analysis of the Woodstock controversy and the latest reporting on the Canadian wildfire haze triggering that statewide health alert, plus more at theoverlooknews.com. That's Noah Eckstein, who is the editor-in-chief of The Overlook, the reader-sponsored nonprofit newspaper serving Hunter, Hurley, Olive, Saugerties, Shandaken, and Woodstock. Noah, thanks so much for joining us. We look forward to talking to you in future.
Yes, thank you so much, Tim. Everybody have a great weekend. Bye.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, it's the latest edition of Curtain Call, the theater podcast hosted by Tom Candela. That's next. You're listening to Radio Chatskill.
Hey, it's Kimberly Izar, host of Farming Country. This week, Jamie Case heads down to the Wallkill River to learn how flooding is changing community gardens.
Some people's plots just look really nicely watered, and other ones were devastated.
Plus, flowers are in full bloom in Jeffersonville. We stop by MoMA Global Flowers to learn about the Japanese art known as Ikebana. Join me this week on Farming Country, Saturday morning at 10 on Radio Catskill.
This week on Science Friday, despite President Trump's efforts to stop it, solar energy is rapidly growing in the U.S.
The cheapest way to make power is to point a sheet of glass at the sun.
Plus, Alzheimer's disease may be tied to low levels of lithium in the brain.
This was so surprising that we didn't believe it at first.
The details on Science Friday from WNYC Studios. Today, from 2 to 4 p.m. on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Every Friday, there's a new episode of our theater podcast, Curtain Call, with Mr. Tom Candela. And Mr. Tom Candela joins us live in studio with a preview of the latest episode. Hi, Tom.
Good morning, Tim. How are you?
I'm good. When I asked you how you were, you said, I'm full of hope.
Full of hope. That's my answer.
That's good.
To the question.
That's a good answer. Yeah. Who are we going to hear from in this episode of Curtain
Call? So this week on Curtain Call, we welcome actor, playwright, and teaching artist Richard Holler to our conversation. Richard is the author of a book, Acting Out, How a Prison Theater Workshop Broke Free. And basically, it's a chronicle of his work bringing theater into correctional facilities. And we're going to talk about his decades-long dedication to creating theater with incarcerated people and formerly incarcerated individuals. And he also developed a theater company coming out of that with people who have come out of prison. And they do productions as we speak. You know,
they're
putting stuff together at the HB Studios in New York City.
That's a great story. And this is an excerpt of that conversation. The full conversation is on the episode that's dropping today at WJFFradio.org or wherever you get your podcast.
Absolutely.
But also as part of that episode, you've got your regular segment that you've been starting now.
The Roving Thespian.
And who are you talking to in that?
Thank you. Thank you for that. Yeah. So I went to go see a production of Renegade. It's put it out by the Catskill Public Theater. And I got to interview a couple of audience members there. If those of you who haven't seen it, you should. It's still playing. You still can get to see it. I think this week it's playing at the Pasta del Oro, at the Something Onion, the Blooming Onion. I have it in the podcast. Got to listen to the podcast.
Got to listen. But this is called a tease, Tom.
Yes. And also they'll be over in Narrowsburg next week, I believe, at the Narrowsburg Union.
And that's an exclusive part of the full episode of the podcast at WJFFradio.org.
Roving Thespian.
Let's listen to your conversation now, which is the main focus of your episode today.
Thank you.
It's Tom Candela and Curtain Call. Thanks, Tom.
Our guest today is Richard Holler, an actor, playwright, teacher, and founder of Acting Out, a professional acting company for formerly incarcerated people. Richard has brought theater into the walls of several prison systems and beyond, helping men who have been written off by society sort of rediscover their humanity through performance. His book, which is out now, called Acting Out, How a Prison Theater Workshop Broke Free, is not just a memoir. It is a testament to theater's transformative power in the most unlikely of places. Richard, I want to welcome you to Curtain Call.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for being here.
Sure.
So I want to go now way back. What was the seed for you that was the acting bug? I know in your book you mentioned a teacher, a Sister Marlene.
Yes. Well, the book starts out with just a little story about Sister Marlene. She made the most profound effect on me of all the teachers that I'd had. She was somebody who took us out of the classroom every day, took us to the theater, took us to museums, to the ballet, to the opera. And she asked me, what did I want to do when I grew up? And I was just so afraid to say I wanted to be an actor. And when I said it, she just said, well, then that's your path.
Right.
And that permission opened something up in me, and I've been doing it ever since.
So when did you start to go in the direction of developing into a teacher?
Well, I've always taught. And then when I got to New York, I started to work for an organization called Young Audiences, where I would go into schools and direct mm-hmm. plays and talent yeah. shows and things like that. And then I met a guy named James O'Barr, who ran a little theater workshop at an upstate prison. And he invited me to come in. James brought me into the workshop, and I taught the workshop at the prison, and I thought it was going to be a one-time deal.
Yeah.
And 15 years later, I was still doing it.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your technique. You mentioned the hello. Tell us a little bit about how that works. And also, you use a physical thing on the floor. You use an X.
What it does is it just creates a center, which is important. Mm-hmm. And then we gather around that center, and someone stands on the X in the center, and we start out with hello, but then the dialogue changes. Mm-hmm. And you walk in and you connect with the person and you just say hello. And it might sound so simplistic and so easy. It is extremely difficult for people to be able to just drop everything, connect with another human being, acknowledge their existence, have them acknowledge yours, and then move on. That is at the heart, to me, of any great scene that you would see on stage. Once they learn how to drop that thing that they need on outside that room, sure, class is over, they go outside, they got to put it back on.
Yes.
But in there, they learn to drop it. But then I think they also recognize times outside where they can drop it, where it's safe to drop it, mm-hmm. and where they can stay human, stay connected, remain a part of a community, which is what I think most of these men have been ostracized from their communities from a very young age.
Right. So you do use these exercises to kind of break down the walls and to kind of get people to connect.
Right. Correct. And have fun. Once that's established and once that trust is there, they open up pretty quickly. I've been using an exercise over the last couple of years that I learned from Mercedes Rule. I call it BioBits, where they sit in a chair and they tell us the story of their life, like in 5 minutes. And I emphasize, you don't have to get into arrests. The first line is, I was born, but you must maintain eye contact with the audience. What happens during that is amazing because they start to have insights about things. They start to see things in a perspective that they never did before. So it's a beautiful exercise, and that leads us into improvisation. And then improvisations lead to scene work. It's designed to start very, very simply and then end up they're performing works by great artists.
Okay, you know? Great. What was the transition where let's put on a show?
The last element of any show is the audience. You don't have theater without an audience.
Right.
So, you know, their training was getting to the point was really good. We found material that was serving everybody really well. And it's like, okay, we need to ramp it up here. We need to bring in people.
I see.
We would do the show for the prison population. Then we also had a special performance for outside guests. But after the prison population came to see it, I would have four or five guys come up to me afterwards and say, how do I get in?
Yeah.
You see the show and I like that. I want to do that.
You mentioned in your book the healing that happens on stage. Can you explain a little bit about what you meant by that?
Usually it's based on a scene. For instance, there's one scene where a father who abandoned his girlfriend and their child, and so many of these men have lived that. I wrote a scene where he comes back and wants to try to make it right, or at least man up and provide some money and some support. To watch them actually play that scene out, something that they've never done in their life, and to see it, to start to feel the feelings that they were afraid to feel, or the shunting aside of their pride for a second because they cared more for the child or the woman or whatever. it's fascinating to see them sort of realize, oh, I'm capable of more than I thought. And mothers and wives and family members, and to watch them watch the men was so moving, because they would watch them play out a domestic scene that maybe they wished had been played out in their own lives.
Right.
But they got to see their husband or their father sort of behave in a way that was so different than what they had known.
Oof. At some point, you decide that you're going to write this book.
I was out with some friends, and I was telling stories just about the thing. And this one guy, Jim, he just kept saying, he says, you got to write this down. You got to write this down. And I was like, oh, yeah, on top of everything else, I'm teaching. I'm running the workshop. I've got my own acting stuff I'm doing. I says, hey, I'm going to write a book. Yeah, right. And he just, every time I would see them, he would just, when are you going to start on that book? So I just started to just scribble. And once I started to really write it, then I got into it, and it no longer seemed like it was like another job for me to do.
Wasn't a task.
So, yeah, no, not at all. I looked forward to every morning I got up and worked on it.
Wow. So. What do you hope people take from it?
Well, first of all, I hope that it gives them a different view of what incarcerated people are like or capable of. But the main thing, to be honest, that I hope people get from it is the power that art, specifically theater, has to transform people's lives, not just the incarcerated, right, not just at-risk youth, but anyone who feels lacking in their humanity. It's like there's an answer to that, the arts.
Right. So out of these groups, we also get a acting company that comes out of that. So tell us about that company.
Yeah. Well, we started in 2020 at HB Studio.
It's called Acting Out. Right?
Acting Out.
At the book. Yep.
Right. Mm-hmm. And we put up shows at HB. We've done 3 full productions, live productions. We remounted a show that we had done on the inside called This Is This. And then most recently, I put together an evening. We called it the Odettes Project, and it was just all Odettes. Okay. And we just did that in January, and we're right now in negotiation with the agent to remount that again in the fall, because there's so many people didn't get to see it, so we want to put it back up again in the fall.
Well, give us some information of where folks who are listening now could go and find out more about Acting Out. And
right. Well, I mean, they can go to my website, richardholer.com, and there's a section in there called Acting Out, which would have information about the company and about the book and everything, and in upcoming productions.
Yep. You've been talking with Richard Holler, and his book, Acting Out, How a Prison Theater Workshop Broke Free, is available through all major bookstores, as well as Amazon and Barnes & Noble, any of those places online. I think you'll be surprised at the things that you learn about these kind of programs and how helpful and transformative they can be and how they change lives. So I want to thank you very much for being on the show, Richard.
My pleasure. Thanks. Great.
It's an excerpt of Curtain Call, the weekly theater podcast from Tom Candela. The new episode with the full conversation and more is at WJFFradio.org. We'll take a break, and when we come back, a new Mexican pop-up has opened in Livingston Manor. It's called Suenas, and it's all about tamales, tostadas, and home cooking memories. We'll find out more after this. It's Radio Chatskill.
On last week's Wait, Wait, Luke Burbank celebrated the return of the presidential fitness test.
I assumed that right after I did the shuttle run at Daniel Bagley Elementary School in Seattle,
yes,
the results were immediately airlifted to President Ronald Reagan for him to analyze.
I'm Tom Papa, in for Peter Sagal. We're joined by the Fantastic Four's Pedro Pascal. That's this week on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
Sunday morning at 10 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. You know those home-cooked meals that instantly take you back, maybe to your childhood or a favorite place? That's exactly the feeling Chef David Perez is going for with their new tamales at Suenos, a Mexican food pop-up in Livingston Manor. I'm talking about corn tamales that are fresh, pork verde tostadas, and a whole lot of flavor. Radio Catskill's Kimberly Izar stopped by Suenos at the Sunshine Colony to check it out and grab a bite.
Okay, right now what I'm doing is I'm taking the hot tamales from the pot and I'm putting them into the steam tray where we keep them warm.
The subtly sweet, earthy smell of corn masa fills the backyard of Sunshine Colony in Livingston Manor.
As you might have guessed, we are corn boys, Steve and I. That's
David Perez. He's the co-owner and chef of Sueños, a Mexican food pop-up you can find on Fridays on Main Street in this hamlet in Sullivan County, New York. Tonight, he and his partner, Steve Snipes, are gearing up for an evening of slinging fresh tamales for the Livingston Manor community.
Tamales are basically corn masa, which is Nick's tamal corn, and it's made into a dough, and then you fill it with whatever you want, like for, you know, it's like a traditional tamale like that people like a lot of rajas or poblano peppers with cheese. We always have that on the menu. Pork tamales, and basically what you do is you like most people when they make tamales, the goal is to find a way to hydrate it with flavor. So some people use broth, some people use a mixture of broth and salsa. My mixture is proprietary. You have to kill me to get it out of me. it's a steamed dough filled with mostly savory flavors, sometimes sweet flavors, and then it's wrapped in a corn husk. So it's steamed in a corn husk, like as you'll probably hear a little bit later. There's some steaming in that pot over there right now, and so we'll have fresh tamales and like. Probably like 7.5 minutes.
Oh my goodness, I'm so excited.
The name of their food pop-up, Sueños, means dream in Spanish. The vision for Sueños kicked off in December of 2024. The duo was already sharing tamales with their friends and community in the area before they landed at their current food residency this past May at Sunshine Colony, a popular natural wine bar. As Perez tells it, he was really missing home-cooked Mexican food after moving to the Catskills.
So Sueños, the joke is that this came out of a series of complaints coming from me where I miss the food that I grew up on. I come from a big Mexican family in L.A. I miss California Mexican food. There's great Mexican food in Sullivan County in New York, but I was missing tamales in specifically, and I was missing food that just reminded me of home. Steve, my partner, told me I had to stop complaining and just make some food. And so it started out as, you know, making tamales for my friends. Like, you know, during the pandemic, I went hard on tamales because that's like I had the time, I had the energy. And then when we moved up here 3 years ago, I started giving like local friends tamales, and through friends at Sunshine Colony and friends at the Junction, we're kind of inspired to do a pop-up. And so I did a pop-up at the Junction like last November, and then we did a Valentine's Day pop-up here at Sunshine Colony for in February, and then we decided to have this residency this summer, and it's been really exciting. It's a lot of work, but I also like I love making Mexican food, and I miss Mexican food. So it's a good way to get me to stop complaining.
I love that. I love it so much. I love also hearing about you growing up eating like tamales with your family. Do you have any memories that stick out for you about like learning how to make them?
I mean, so I feel like every generation in my family has like the tamale person, and like sadly, my great aunt Irene just passed away, but she was like the tamale person. Like no one was as good as her, and no one will ever be as good as her, you know what I mean? And her and my great aunt Maria were like the tamale ladies, right? And so I never really grew up learning how to make tamales, because I was like, someone does this better than me, you know, there's no way I'm ever going to be this good. And then I learned a little bit from my uncle, who's inspired me the most out of people. Like, he's the one I learned to cook from the most. And so it was a mixture of just trying to recreate what I learned from them, and then also like trying to pour, you know, my desires and my interests into it. And so, you know, here, like, we do a lot of traditional tamales, but then sometimes we'll take a few departures and with toppings and things that are like not specifically like linked to my family's recipes. We try to have a vegan tamale, which is really hard to find in LA.
The flavor of tamales itself can be relatively mild, but it's the fillings and seasonings that pack in the flavor. Tamales have a long history dating back as far as 8000 BC during the pre-Columbus Mesoamerican era. Today, they're a staple in Mexican households. The joy of unwrapping a fresh tamale brings back fond memories for many, even for me. When I lived in California a few years ago, my dear roommate's mom would stack our freezer with homemade tamales for the Bay Area's colder nights. Prez admits that running a food pop-up outdoors underneath a white canopy tent can sometimes be challenging, but their partnership with Sunshine Colony has made it more manageable and more fun.
I think it's really important right now that we are focusing on, like, just fostering a sense of community locally that feels connected and progressive and also, like, supportive in, like, a period of time that feels pretty grim.
He adds that since they've been selling their menu, the outpouring of community has been overwhelmingly positive.
I think tamales are, they fall on one side of the line. Like, either they're, like, super new to people and we have to educate people. I hate the word educate. I have to show people how to eat it. Some people don't know you have to unwrap the corn, and we try to show them in a way that doesn't make them feel stupid. And then some people are like, know what tamales are, but just, like, can't find them up here. And so it is, like, a special treat. And everyone's been really generous and really supportive, and especially, like, other business owners around here who have, like, really taken us under their wing and helped us, like, with the pragmatic and just the, you know, the emotional support you need when you start a food project. So we have two kinds of tamales in here right now. We've got a rajas, which is poblano and cheese, and then we have a local corn tamale. And as a lot of people will say, you know, aren't all tamales corn? It's true, they are. What we do is we make, like, a corn broth, and we hydrate the masa with that, and then we put some shucked local corn whole into the masa, so it's like a very corn forward, celebrating the season of corn that's just started up here.
Smells amazing.
Thank you.
Perez and Snipes prepare about 60 tamales a week, and they said the community has been really receptive to their menu, especially families.
I've never met a child that doesn't like a tamale, and if I do, that child is possessed by the devil. You heard it here first, listeners.
In addition to their tamales, they also have other items. The pork verde tostada, an elote salad topped with cotija cheese, and a few different kinds of quesadillas. And of course, there are salsas. Salsa roja, verde, and a pina tomatillo. Perez says they want to have a piece of their childhood traditions accessible for everyone.
We try to make sure that, like, when people come here, they can have a substantive meal, or they could treat this like a snack in the middle of the day, a snack before they have reservation, an end of the night thing. We try to make sure that we can hit everyone as far as their hunger level goes, but also, you know, making sure that, like, we can hit all types of, like, budgets and price points.
For Perez, cooking is how he and his partner connect with their community. For them, that's never felt more important than right now.
I think that often when we, like, miss our hometown or, like, miss a connection to, like being far away from your family, like, I think food is an obvious way in, but I always wanted to, like, around Christmas when I was missing my family, I wanted to make my kitchen smell like it did for, like, you know, generation after generation. And I think here, I think, you know, in this period of time where trying to find connective tissue to our communities and to our neighbors in this, like, really weird world where people are defunding public radio, which is nonsense, is that I think for me it's important to, like, I care about what I cook, and I care about not just what I make, but how we make it and how we present it. And I think what it means to me is it gives me a sense of, like, trying to be part of a community in a way that's, like, you know, like a really unsophisticated way of service, I guess, or just trying to, like, share something that's important with to people that are around me.
In Livingston Manor, I'm Kimberly Izar for Radio Catskill.
Well, now I'm hungry and going to get hungrier because Bagel Festival is Sunday in Monticello. Come see us there. Have a great weekend. That's all for this edition from Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
I'm Jason Tugaw, host of The Mixtape. I play classics you love, deep cuts, and brand new music. Friday nights at 7, only on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. The forecast, we looks like we're in a stretch of sunny days. Today, a high 77. Saturday, Sunday, highs in the low to mid-80s. And temperatures in the evening, 53 tonight, 56 Saturday, low of 60 on Sunday. On Point is next. It's 11 o'clock.